Welcome to the Mother Love Podcast. This is Claire Larson, your host, and this project was made possible because of the support of Healthy Mothers, Healthy Babies, the Montana Coalition. Mother Love was created to promote healing, connection, and shared wisdom through stories. Like any given day spent parenting, each episode brings a balance of tears, laughter, wonder, and surrender. When it comes to parenting, no one should go it alone. On Mother Love, we see you. We hear you. We're in this together.
Hi, Mother Love listeners. It's Claire. I'm here with Dawn Gunderson today, and we're continuing our series of Behind the Scenes with HMHB. And we started with Brooke this last week, our producer, and now Dawn is here, and Dawn does some incredible work for Healthy Mothers, Healthy Babies. And there are so many reasons that I want to have Dawn on, but I'm not even going to list them because you'll find out what they are. But Dawn, hi, good morning.
Good morning, Claire. Thanks for having me.
Mm-hmm. Will you start by telling our listeners what your job is at HMHB, what your role is, and what you spend your time doing for us?
Sure, I'd love to. I am the Program and Communications Coordinator for Healthy Mothers, Healthy Babies. And two of the main programs that I work on are our LIFS Online Resource Guide, and then also our Essentials Program that helps provide cribs and car seats to agencies throughout the state working with families in need.
Yeah, which is amazing. I used to get to help with that program, and it's one of the more direct services that we provide at Healthy Mothers, Healthy Babies. And we get to know a little bit more about the people who are helping these families, and also a little bit about the families, and just have a vision of the difference that this is making in their life, which is really, really feels good to know. There's that. And then you also have a background in public health and specifically helping moms and families and parents. So maybe you can talk a little bit about that, because I know that contributes to what you do at HMHB too.
Yeah. So I started with the health department as their behavioral health coalition coordinator. They started as a substance use disorder coalition and then turned into kind of mental health and substance use disorders because of the co-occurring within communities. And so I loved that work. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of working on the population as a whole throughout the county, and then obviously how that helped families and young children as well. And then I was part of the State WIC program. And so I worked with families with children age 5 and then down to moms during pregnancy. And so it's obviously kind of a food program that provides some supplemental foods, but we got to do a lot of education and just, helping those families find resources that they needed. And so I love public health. So thanks to all the public health workers out there. You guys are amazing. Shout out.
Yeah. And maybe because WIC is a really well-known program, but what if there are some listeners who don't know about it? Let's really quickly just summarize what WIC is.
Okay, WIC stands for Women's, Infants, and Children. And like I said, it kind of provides some supplemental foods, healthy foods for the families, for those children, and then also for pregnant moms. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the goal of it, is that supplemental foods. But in addition, they come in to the clinic and we do heights and weights and breastfeeding, lactation consultation, and then just like I said, education for families during that time period of life. And one of the great things is those resource and referrals to other services within the community and then outside of the community as needed.
Yeah, it's often one of the most common entry points for people realizing what's available to them for support from public health, I think.
I was with the Teton County Health Department located in Shoto, Montana. And so I live in Shoto with my family, and then I get to work for Healthy Mothers, Healthy Babies from home, and then do some traveling to Helena for team meetings and then conferences throughout the state as well.
Yeah. And you get to bring a unique perspective of what rural life is like for families, as well as families who really struggle with transportation barriers. So that's one thing that I know that having you on the team has been really helpful to just help us to understand that, us city folk, to understand what it's like and what those particular needs look like. You are a mom. Tell us about what that looks like.
I am. I am a mother of 6 children. Our oldest is 19 and just finished her freshman year at college. And then our youngest is 7 and she's a first grader. And so I have been a mother for several years and learned a lot of wonderful and a lot of hard lessons throughout that. And so my husband and I have been married for almost 20 years and obviously lead very, very busy lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One thing that I love is, so Stephanie, who's our program director, she always talks about, like, we're just always like, how does Dawn do it?
You have to kind of give up some things, right, mm-hmm. as you go. So the house is not going to be as clean and things aren't just going to be so-so. And then you get to the point where there's 8 people living in the house. And that's a real stretch to be able to let go that much. And I have definitely struggled with that. And mm-hmm. so doing dishes is just something that my entire family hates to do, as mm-hmm. well as me. But mm-hmm. I do care that they are done very well, especially when you're sharing so many germs in this household. And so that's just one thing I've decided, okay, that is me. There's mm-hmm. just, I'm going to do it and it's going to be okay. And I'm going to live through it. And they can mm-hmm. help me with other chores that, you know, can be a little less done.
Yes. Yeah. I remember one of my friends when, I think it was after I had Kendall and Kyla was still really little. She was just like 2. And I remember talking to her about, like, I just can't keep the house clean anymore. And she was like, she just looked me dead in the eye. And she's like, Claire, that's not a thing anymore. Like right then she was like, let go of that. Like, that's not going to be a thing anymore. Like, you're never going to have, at least for the next few years, you're not going to have a clean, organized, perfect house like you're used to. And I know that's very calming for you. I know it really helps you feel better. She's like, but you're just going to have to find other ways to calm yourself and soothe yourself, because like, that's not going to be it anymore. And I just remember being like feeling simultaneously like relief wash over me. And like that grief of like, really? Like, that can't be a thing anymore. I love having a clean house, you know, and it, mm-hmm. it things as a new mom that you do have to choose, like, to take care of your body, but also like, you will go insane if you just follow your toddler around picking up after them. Like, I think of like the people at the carnival with like the broom and dustpan, that they're just like constantly like walking behind people and like sweeping mm-hmm. up garbage. And that's how I felt when my kids were toddlers. I was just like, I will just follow you around and make sure that everything stays tidy. And then what I wasn't doing was playing with them and engaging with them. And, you know, it was like, once I realized that, I was like, okay, clean house. Thing anymore. Yeah.
No, I think that's a huge point of stress for me, because I feel so much more at ease and I feel so much more productive mentally if my surroundings are like picked up and organized. Yeah. And so, you know, we live a very, very busy life. And so from the minute kids are out of school, we're doing activities and to just not feel like you're meeting what you need to be doing.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And that's a good segue into part of why you agreed, after I basically have been spending the last couple of weeks just begging everybody at Healthy Mothers, Healthy Babies to be on this series of the podcast. And they're like, I don't know. And I was like, yes, but you do know and you're coming on. No, but really, I've been quite persuasive. And the reason is because a lot of the people that I work with have lived experience with exactly what we get to help people with on their parenting journeys. And so for you, Dawn, maybe you could tell listeners some of what, after I aggressively approached you to come on the podcast? Like some of the things that you thought, oh, okay, like if I can open up and share this, it could actually be really valuable and really helpful to listeners because of take it over, passing the torch to you.
Take it over. Oh, there's so many things. I was thinking about this podcast and sharing and just thinking about, I feel like I do a really, really good job in my professional life. I love Healthy Mothers, Healthy Babies mission. I love the team. I love all of the partners that we get to work with that are so invested in the health of families in Montana. And sometimes I feel like, you know, I am on it. And then I think about how I feel like I'm falling apart in other ways, but that realism of that falling apart at times and that rebuilding and, you know, kind of this roller coaster of motherhood and parenthood and just being a woman in our society really kind of helps us in our work. You know, I think we can have those tough conversations and sometimes that feels a little raw because, you know, a lot of people think we have it all together. And I know I don't, but there's this like scary part of if I really open up, is am I still going to be respected in ways that I feel like, you know, I should be or I want to be or what have you. But, you know, the reality of my life is that ever since I can remember, ever since childhood, I dealt with very, very high levels of anxiety and hypervigilance to the extent that it has made me sick physically. I have really tough days of just going through the motions because I feel this sense of danger all the time. And this has been something that I have lived with since I was young. And then you think of all these journeys we go through, and then inevitably now as a 46-year-old woman with six kids and a job and lots of responsibilities, I finally sought inpatient care for help because of how destructive this anxiety has become in my life.
Yes. And I think when we think about the reluctance to share our struggles and our raw pieces of ourselves because we're afraid that maybe people won't respect us or think that we have it together enough to do this work, you know, the more I find that we do, the more respect actually comes because people realize that you're like walking the walk, right? Like you're not just coming at this from a place of authority or like, I know all of this so well, so I'm going to tell you what to do because I know better than you do or whatever. It's like not that power sort of hierarchy. Instead, it's like, I've been exactly where you are and here's what has helped. And it's okay to like have wounds and have imperfections and flaws and to continue to pursue growth and ask for help anyways. And so it's this interesting like intersection of vulnerability and then embracing that there's strength in vulnerability and that we give other people permission to really embrace their whole journeys too. And so I think that like it's always really interesting how that feels like kind of a contradiction, but it's actually it can be the most helpful. And sorry, I'm going on a little bit. I'll be done talking in a second. But just thinking about the work we specifically do, there's a lot of training and education that goes into our work so that we're staying up on what is most helpful, what's research-based, all these things. And so in doing that, sometimes we have to learn about really hard things that are mistakes that we've made. And then we learn the impact on what that did to our kids in their earliest development. And that is so hard sometimes because you have to own those mistakes, know that they really impacted your kiddo know that they impacted the connection, attachment, and relationship. And then you have to be willing to find forgiveness, self-compassion, and repair. And we'll talk about that a little bit more, but just in terms of our roles at our job, that can be really hard. And I've had conversations with you one-on-one where it's like, can we ever undo the damage that we accidentally did when we didn't know better?
Mm-hmm. Ooh. we talked about coming into this podcast how this is really, really raw. This is hard stuff because, you know, my journey over the last couple months, I am just like shortly removed from coming home from a month of therapy in March. And, you know, you do all this work, you just do all this work to get help and to really think through these things. And it is so, so very important that we get help and that we start feeling better. But there is this other side of coming home and, you know, how will you be received? And will it look like you've done the work? And will you be able to use all these, you know, tools that you have, you know, put into practice over the last month, and you're feeling really confident in about, like, what if you get home and the acceptance isn't what you hope it will be? And what if you screw up, you know, again, and you fall back into something? And that's so tough because you know that you need to ask for forgiveness and you need to repair and restore relationships. And some of the hardest things are thinking about, I can't believe that because I didn't get a hold of this anxiety earlier, that has had effects on my children. That has had, you know, emotional effects. And I hear so much about postpartum depression and the effects that can have on your children. And then, you know, on my end, it was just this immense anxiety. And what my infant and then my children, as they've been growing up, the effects that stress of my own, then they are feeling as well.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, there's a lot of guilt that goes with that. And then, you know, if we don't recognize, you know, the guilt and try to heal in a better way through that and receive therapy. And, you know, as my kids have become older, you know, really talk to them about it, then, you know, this sense of shame comes into play. And that is a really, really hard thing. I think we talk a lot about how, you know, we've come to find help, how the help has helped, and how we've gotten better in dealing with our mood disorders or our mental health issues. But there's not a lot of talk about then what happens. Then what happens about, okay, we're better, but we are still feeling all that guilt of, exactly, you know, how we've hurt our family or our friends or our children, kind of on the other side of that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a whole podcast within itself, right?
Yeah. Yeah,
that's one thing that's, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, there's that. And it's like, sometimes it's like, you know, ignorance is bliss. And the more we learn about something, the more we have to face it. And facing it can be really daunting. And then one thing that you and I talked about, you know, is I had more of an experience of postpartum depression. And that's what I saw modeled, you know, bless my poor mom, but she was in the thick of it. And then we talked about how depression tends to really level you and kind of put you like out of commission. But anxiety and hypervigilance kind of kicks you into this hyper productivity. And one of those is really looked down upon in our society. And one of them is kind of celebrated. like the idea of like air quotes supermom, right? Where you like, you're so anxious and you're so hypervigilant that you're like, go, 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 going. And even though that ultimately leads to like burnout and on the way to burnout, like a lot mm-hmm. of destructive behaviors that are created that are tormenting for you, but also you're so busy, it's hard to notice it's happening, you know? Yeah. And so I feel like that's one reason that there isn't as much focus on postpartum anxiety and OCD as there is postpartum depression. Cause it's like, shoot, if somebody gets hit with depression, they're like out, like they can't function, mm-hmm. they can't do anything, they can't even get up and shower and can barely care for their baby. But when it's anxiety, it's like this thing of, wow, look at her go.
Yeah, I think yes. And I just want people to know that, you know, it may look like that on the outside, but mm-hmm. on the inside, it's like you're falling apart.
Totally.
On the inside. You know, if I kind of think about the progression of my anxiety, when I say that, you know, I don't remember a time not feeling it, was, I guess an example of that would have been my parents going to my teacher's conference and going to those teachers' conferences, and at home, just my body being just in knots, like felt sick to my stomach. The worry was just like immense. I knew that I was was performing well in school. There weren't any behavior problems. There was really no reason for me to feel all of that, yet I did. And then, you know, when I became pregnant, it was this, I was going to take care of my body the best I could because I was growing this child. And then after I delivered my daughter, after her birth, I was extremely anxious because to me, I was this little girl's advocate. She couldn't help herself. This was my job, and I was going to do it to the best of my ability. It was my job to protect her, and that was who I was and what I was going to do. And so then as my children grew up and were in that toddler and young elementary stage, there was just this sense that something was going to happen constantly. Like there was this incredible danger ahead. And so I think about it, like people probably saw that differently. They probably saw it as, you know, oh, she's just on it. Oh, she's at all her kids' activities. Oh, she's this, that, and the other thing. She's, you know, one example would be I would finally let my kids ride to school on a beautiful day. And granted, we live in a small town and it's not very far and all of those things. But I would, 10 minutes later, I would drive over to the school and make sure that their bikes were in the bike rack. And that time from when they left till when I saw that their bikes were in the bike rack was just this intense emotion inside of me, just this fear, this incredible fear. And that can also be looked at some other ways. Like I remember people saying, well, you're so paranoid, you know, mm-hmm. or, oh, you're totally a helicopter parent. Mm-hmm. So that it got to that extreme too. And I kind of took offense to that because to me, I was like, what do you mean? I'm protecting my children.
Right. Yeah. And there's so much judgment on either side. Right. And, mm-hmm. and, or like you're saying, like, there's like a cheering on and being like, yeah, yeah, go Dawn. Like she's so on it. She's everywhere. And she's doing everything. She's like, we were talking about before we started, like she's omnipresent. Right. Like, and wow, she's like really caring for her kids. And you were doing it from a place of love, you know, and then there are the other parents that are just like, whoa, ease up. Like you're a control mm-hmm. freak. You're a helicopter parent. And what's hard about both of those extremes is like, it's just a clear misunderstanding of what that was like for you and how that affected like the inner workings of your family. Mm-hmm. And so I know that this continued to persist for you for like a long time. And mm-hmm. you weren't able to, or, you know, were, it's like the water you swim in, right? So you weren't able to recognize that you needed help. And so maybe you can talk about like, just a little bit about that, about as your kids continued to grow and this began to feel more and more consuming, like what was that like?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know actually that I would say it was more consuming, but as my children got older, there was more pushback. And so what it then became was, you know, I had teenagers and I still was feeling this protectiveness, right? That only I could protect my child, you know, or my husband. And so, you know, there was like going out to the lake with friends and, you know, there was, you know, my kids getting their driver's license and wanting to stay out later. And I would just come up with all these reasons that they shouldn't or they couldn't go because I had this extreme fear and I was terrified to let them, you know, out of my sight. And for them, it felt like, my mom does not trust me. Like, yeah. She does not trust who I am. She definitely won't allow me to make any mistakes because if I do, oh no, like she's, you know, she's going to lose it. And I think that it was even a sense of like not losing it to endanger them, but like my mom's mental state is not going to be good, you know? And right. They were recognizing that and seeing that. And, you know, I think that that caused them to feel incredibly angry toward me, you know, and tried to really pull back. And so I was seeing the effects now of my children as they were making their own decisions, you know. And then here's my husband kind of caught in the middle of it because he knows that some of these things that I'm kind of being so emotional about. And so anxiety ridden and kind of angry about, like, he knows that that's not right, right? He knows yeah. that, you know, the kids should have a little bit more leeway. Like, they are growing up, you know, they're going to make decisions. And sometimes those are not going to be the best decisions. But he's really thinks that, you know, hey, let them make those decisions and mess up a little bit while they're still at home so that we can help them get through that. So that when they have to do it on their own, you know, they have some more skills. And I was so fearful about that. I was so, so fearful that the worst thing was going to happen. And so that also put a strain on my marriage because I really felt like he was being too lenient and he was kind of betraying me because he didn't understand how scary that was. And, you know, on my kid's side, he was like just trying to be fair, you know? Yeah. And so there was a lot of strain there too. So it just seemed that my actions and my reactions toward moving through my anxiety were becoming more destructive.
Yeah. I can see that.
Yeah. And, you know, I had sought therapy in the past and I had sought medication in the past and I had sought God's word in the past. And there were times that things got a little bit better, but honestly, like I just wasn't consistent enough at all of them. And it's really hard to kind of take a time out and say, all right, let's get this in a better place. Like, let's start feeling better, Dawn, so that everybody, you know, it's a healthier environment for everyone else. And so we had a little bit of an intervention in our house. And so, my husband and my daughter, it had gotten really strained and stressful. And my husband and my oldest daughter kind of sat me down and said, you know, you need to go someplace and get help. Like you can't commit to, you know, getting help in the intensive therapy that you need right there, staying in this environment. Mm-hmm. And that was really hard.
Yeah.
You know, I went through these hesitations, like, you know, I had not spent even, you know, more than a week away from my kids ever. And, you know, who was going to who was going to take care of them. You know, it takes my husband and I, and sometimes friends and family members to keep everything going. Luckily, we had a wonderful support system. I just didn't utilize it as much as I could have and probably should have. And then, like, how would it work without me? You know, who's going to keep track of everything?
Totally.
And then there was this barrier of being a woman of faith and having these hesitations of, if I go, you know, and if I really make this big stand to go and leave my family for 30 days, is that showing a lack of faith? Yeah. You know? And so I was just in prayer for the next couple days, just in constant prayer. And we were looking at facilities, my husband, my daughter, and myself. And I just was not feeling any sense of that was the right thing to do. And then we came across a faith-based treatment program for anxiety. And I called and talked to someone there for a while, and then I started to feel a little bit better about it. And then I asked him, you know, can I have my husband call, and, you know, whatever questions he wants to ask, you know, I'm free that you share everything with him. And then a couple days later, I made the decision that, you know, basically was on the plane to go within a couple of days. And that was scary. That was scary for me. It was like, I think I was just waiting for this sign for me from God to say, like, hey, this is the right thing to do. This is okay. And I got that sense of peace. And, you know, I want to spend enough time, I guess, on that, because I think that there is, I mean, I think as a faith-based community, people are being more open to talk about mental health struggles, maybe outside of visiting about it with their leadership within their church or congregation. Or, you know, there's many ways to think of, there's many different faiths, there's many different forms of spirituality. But it's this sense of God or a higher power. You know, it's a little bit fearful to say, you know, I'm going to go get a little bit of help elsewhere. Because for me, it wasn't getting help really elsewhere. It was just getting some more help to help me cope through the day. So I still, there was this huge understanding that if God wanted to heal this, he could do it immediately. He hadn't done it yet. And so during that time, I was going to continue to pray for healing. I was going to continue to pray for helping me through this anxiety. I was going to still be steadfast in my prayer, but I needed some other help. And that can be really hard sometimes for people of faith or people that follow something bigger than themselves. It can be a really difficult decision to say, I think God's going to be okay with this, you know? And so I did, and I got on that plane, and it's just, I get a little bit emotional even thinking about it now. There was just this overwhelming peace that I got when I kind of settled into my seat on the airplane. And to me, it was something I could only describe as divine intervention. It was not of me. It was something I'd never felt before. It was definitely of God. And at that moment, I knew, like, this is what I'm supposed to do. And all of that fear of leaving my family, you know, this person who was just like every move that everybody made, I had to know what they were doing and how they were doing it and who they were with. That was just this peace that everything was going to be okay, that God was going to handle it and my family was going to handle it and everybody was going to be okay. And at that point, I think I was able to commit to that entire process. You know, I was like, okay, I am not going to spend time with that. God is like, he's taking that fear away right now. And I'm going to commit to this process and I'm going to do the work and I'm going to get better and I'm going to lean into God's word. And I'm also going to lean into all the medical interventions and the therapies and the tools. And so I was able to make that decision because we found a faith-based treatment program. Mm-hmm. And so I think one of the goals of this, of sharing this, is that there's so many different entry points into help. And our faith-based communities are a place, are an entry point, you know, and I think, you know, I would hope just that the medical professionals and family and friends would recognize that. And then also that, you know, medical professionals would also recognize that for some people, their faith has to be together with that medical intervention for true healing for some of us to be able to work toward.
Right. Yeah. And I think it's that piece that you talk about, right, that came over you. It's like we hear the piece that passes all understanding. But like another way to say that is like, it just doesn't make sense. It's like a piece that just doesn't make sense. There's no reason to feel peaceful in that moment, right? That should be like the height of your anxiety, is like when you're on the plane, you're flying away from your family, all the worry is fresh and right there and present. And like for someone who struggled with anxiety their entire life, that should have been like panic attack mode, right? But it was completely the opposite, which is like the way that you could tell, like, oh, this isn't coming from me. Because if I was feeling the way that I know how to feel about this, I would be like hyperventilating, right? Mm-hmm. And I've had that experience as well in my life when Kyla was really sick. We talked about that, but she was in the hospital and really in like the pediatric ICU type situation where I had nothing left. And I just remember feeling that same sort of like, peace and calm in the hospital room that made zero sense to me. I was like, I almost felt bad about it. Honestly, I was like, how can I be feeling so calm right now? Like when this is the scariest moment of our lives, you know? And so I just think, I think that's real. I've felt it. And I think that it's interesting to think about the piece where you did have to learn that it was okay to integrate help that is medically based and comes from a like Western medicine perspective with your faith, because I think, like you said, oftentimes there's a reluctance to ask for help because you're afraid you'll be judged by your church or by your community and be labeled as like, well, you should be able to get better just from prayer, or you should be able to heal or like rely on healing. And if you don't, then that's a lack of faith and a fault of your own. And you just need to like try harder. Mm-hmm. And we know with any sort of mental illness that can be really overwhelming and debilitating, the fact that you just need to try harder is like the most damning advice there possibly could be, because we're trying really hard. It's mm-hmm. just the way that we know how to try isn't working anymore.
But I did have this internal struggle because I know very well that God can heal. Mm-hmm. But I know that he doesn't always heal, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that he also gives us ways to seek help in other ways. You know, he tells us to, you know, take care of our bodies, you know, and that to me is physically and mentally and emotionally. And, you know, he tells us to ask for help. And I still believe he's the ultimate healer. But until or if I don't become healed from all of this, I'm going to do the best job I can to lean into his word and then to also seek other ways to feel better.
Right.
And other ways, meaning like healthy ways, right? Mm-hmm. And so, So, you know, that entire month of March, you know, I went to this faith-based inpatient program. And, you know, for me, I was choosing to resonate and, you know, reignite my faith and my relationship with Christ and really read and think about what God says about me and how the Bible tells me to deal with struggle and to handle struggle. But I also had this ability to utilize these incredibly tools by like licensed professionals to teach me and to counsel me with day-to-day coping skills as well that help me. So, you know, it's really, I think it's hard maybe to explain sometimes, but, you know, when this anxiety would arise, you know, I was in prayer and I was also kind of using these tools. And so one of the things that I tend to do is in the medical field, what they would call like catastrophizing, I would always think that the worst thing was going to happen. Right. Yeah. So I kind of talked about the lake. Like if my kids went to the lake, the worst thing was going to happen. They were either going to get in an accident or they'd be screwing around on the deck and somebody would push somebody off and, you know, there'd be a head injury and then somebody would drown. I mean, to say it out loud right now seems really absurd. And I'm sure that's what people thought as well. But those are things that would happen to me, you know? So I would, you know, from a medical standpoint, I would have to realize, okay, this is what you're doing, Dawn. You're like catastrophizing the situation. Like you're thinking about the worst thing that would happen. And so like, let's think about the probability of that. Or what evidence do you have that you would think that would actually happen? Not that things like that couldn't happen, but every single thing my kids did, I was catastrophizing it. Like that is a really, really hard way to live.
Yeah.
You know, another thing similar to that would be kind of that all or nothing mentality. So, you know, for me, things are either good or they're bad. You know, there's nothing in between, or they're, you know, they're black or they're white, black being good and white being bad. And so, and nothing in between. Mm-hmm. And so that realization that there, you know, there was no feeling in between is really tough. Like there wasn't a little bit of like worry or hesitation about letting your child go somewhere. It was like when they went, like the most horrible thing was going to happen and you were going to have to live your, you know, without your children. And how would you handle that emotionally? And what would that do to your other children? And I mean, this is like the reality of right. what I was feeling. Yeah. And so, I really had to think about it. Like, okay, like there was no like 4, 5, or 6 for me. Mm-hmm. And I really needed to kind of, you know, dive into that and try yeah. to think about things differently. And one exercise, which I'm sure several therapists had used, but it was really helpful for me, was I had to carry around this color wheel for a couple days. And so basically thinking, you know, I either see things black or white, good or bad, again, like the sense of prayer plus these kind of tools to help through the coping skills, to help through day-to-day activities. The combination of those is what is working for me right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting. A couple things that came to me while you were sharing that is like, when we think about catastrophizing and having those black and white thoughts, it's like, okay, well, if this catastrophe is going to happen, and I'm pretty sure it will, then the only antidote to that is to keep my kids like locked in their bedroom, right? So like that's yeah. the thing, the behavior of anxiety and like that feeling of like having obsessive thoughts and like feeling just compelled to keep everyone safe on lockdown. But then like you said, you're missing out on like all the potential mistakes, yes, that could happen. Hopefully they won't be fatal errors, but right. also you're missing out on all the good stuff, right? And this isn't like a new, like Claire's coming up with this philosophy, but when we don't know how to learn to live in the in-between, we miss out on both the good and the really scary. It's like, we have to learn how to live in that uncertainty and let life kind of unfold as it's going to, and ask for help to stay calm and easeful during that, rather than like, oh my God, if this thing's going to happen, then I have to make sure that I'm like keeping everything in check on this end. And that's mm-hmm. that experience of like black and white thinking Also, I think it's interesting when we talk about healing that I think a lot of there's a tendency to go like way, way back in like stories of healing that happened like on the spot, instantaneously, complete full healing. Lots of people saw it. It had an impact. And it's like, if you think about the story and the context of that, like that is at that time what needed to happen in order to like bring attention to what was going on in that period of time. But now, if you look at like the society and the culture and the conditions that we're living in, it's like healing and having that be an ongoing thing where you are able to embrace medication and therapy. And, you know, it's a very different time and everything is fast paced and everyone has their attention in a million directions. And so what healing looks like now for you might actually be more useful if it's like a realization and then a process that happens that your family can witness and learn from and experience healing alongside you, rather than just like if you were all of a sudden woke up tomorrow and had zero anxiety, there'd be a lot less who could relate to that and actually find hope in it, because it would be like, wow, this crazy thing happened for Dawn, but like, I bet that's not going to happen to me because that's so crazy and rare and like miracles don't happen anymore and whatever. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that that isn't still possible, but sometimes it's like the more we are able to embrace like all the things that are involved in healing, the more people can be like, okay, well, maybe that's possible for me too. And I do think that could be a beneficial way to kind of reframe the healing process and say like, we can still make mistakes and ask for grace and cultivate self-compassion and let others see us stumble. Mm-hmm. And that like, that's healing in ways that we can't even comprehend sometimes.
Yeah, I know. Gosh, Claire, you're so good at this. You're just, I mean, that's what I want, right? I want people, that's my intention of sharing this like tough stuff. Like, I want people to find help, however that looks to them. But sometimes in this faith community, we need to know that it's okay to seek help elsewhere, you know, and also to, you know, just kind of thinking back to some of the conversations with some of the people that were there at the treatment program the same time I was, you know, one had been intentional in her prayer and felt like I should probably seek therapy too. And, she just thought, I'll just go to a therapist, right? Well, the therapist that she went to wasn't open to also hearing her talk about her faith. And so wasn't, I guess, willing, if you will, to integrate that as well into the therapy. And so that wasn't a good place for her to be. So she then, you know, found a faith-based therapist. And so, that worked for her. And for me, when I came back home, the intention is to find someone who is a licensed therapist, who has all this medical background and tools, but also is a woman of faith or a man of faith. And so, and because that's important for me, that integration is what helps it. You know, I want to talk about the tools and the coping skills and working through all of my emotions. I need to have that therapy as well as seeking God's word. And for me, when I think about it, you know, God wants me to have a peace. That's what he wants for me. And he gives me, you know, he tells me what to do to find that, to abide in him and to trust in him. It also is helpful, though, for me to say, Dawn, you're catastrophizing this situation. You're thinking about only the worst thing that happens. And there, that is a connection for me. And I just hoped that if this is speaking to people, that there probably is a large population of us. I mean, if we look at Montana as a whole, religion, if you want, I call it faith because of I believe in God and Jesus Christ. And but some people may call it religion, depending on what they believe is their higher power. But like more than 50% of the state of Montana on, you know, certain surveys and things like that show that people are of some type of faith or religion. And so not to say that any or all say, you know, not to seek therapy outside of their congregation or community of believers. But there's, you know, still people, for me, it was internal. I was feeling that struggle internally, you know, like, yeah. I know God can heal me, but right now that healing hasn't come. He's helping me through this, but there's still enough of this like destructive behavior that I'm having that is suffocating my family.
Right. And why can't it be both, right? I mean, why can't the understanding be that it's not a lack of faith, it's actually something that's being provided for you. Mm-hmm. If you are open to that idea, then it can be, like you're saying, it can be both. And it can be like, you know, we think that it should look one way. And that's the whole like free will thing, right? Like we think it should look one way. And we think if we do X, Y, and Z, it's going to lead to like healing and never having to worry about our kids ever again and all these things. But mm-hmm. like sometimes what has happened in my life is being like, actually, like I've tried every possibility possible and I've exhausted every single avenue I can. And I've learned every single lesson the hard way 5 times. And guess mm-hmm. what? Like I'm pretty tired. Like mm-hmm. this isn't working. And so then it's like you start to seek like, okay, maybe there is something bigger than me. Maybe there's something outside of my own like programming that's running all of this that is going to be the path to healing. And that mm-hmm. is, that's like something that's really, I think it's just our own understanding is coming from a place that's flawed a lot of times, especially if we're struggling with thoughts and mental illness. That mm-hmm. means that we are in the habit of believing thoughts that are possibly like really not true and really destructive. And so seeking help outside of that, you know, whether you go to your faith community or your support network or God or, you know, whatever way it is, looking for help outside of that is probably after you've done what I've done and run up against a dead end 25 times, it might be something to consider. You know, like, oh, guess what? This isn't working again. So, mm-hmm. I mean, and that's like that's something that I return to again and again in my life. It's like, oh, I got this. And then I'm like, oh, you know what? Actually, I don't got this. Like mm-hmm. I thought I did. So I think that's part of healing too, is it can look really differently than we think.
Yeah. And I think another thing to, you know, share is that I may have to live with this sense of anxiety mm-hmm. for the rest of my life. You know, I may never be completely healed of it. And just going to that inpatient, intensive, you know, program of, you know, being in God's word and, you know, having this medical intervention and therapies for 30 days, like full days of really good, like heartwarming, hard, realizing, you know, practicing coping skills, all of that, right? Even after all of that, I came home with a sense of tools and, you know, direction. But I'm not completely healed. And I still, you know, am having those tendencies, but I am dealing with them, Claire, so much better. And I feel, yes. Yeah. And I am okay with that little bit of stress comes up because I can call it out,
yeah.
You know, and I can recognize from the education I received what it is and what to do with it. And to be really honest, like I've been in this field for a while. So it wasn't that I didn't know exactly what it was, but I didn't, I guess, know what to do with it. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't had any practice. And things just like, you know, if you think about six kids and your husband, and every time they leave the house or they're out of your sight, they're potentially like worried constantly. When do you have time to focus in on that, you know?
Totally.
And so although, you know, not everyone can go away for 30 days. They, you know, they can't, but the to make that time to gain that education and to use those skills. And I am, you know, I can say, you know, it's May 8th, you know, and after that whole month of, you know, March being away, like, it has been better. Life has been better for all of us at this house. Not that there aren't mistakes, and not that there are times I have to go back and say, gosh, I am really sorry. You know, this is what I was doing. And I, you know, have recognized I've done that. And I apologize. And, you know, I ask that they give me a little grace and patience, because this is a process. But I can say that things are getting better, and I'm enjoying life a lot more, and I'm sure my family is too. Because, you know, I still hear sirens, you know, in our small community, and I still text my family and say, everybody good? I heard sirens. Yeah. And they still like text me back and let me know, yeah, we're okay. But I'm not in total panic mode until they text me back, you know, or I'm not texting them five times and calling them in the course of 5 minutes, you know. And so, you know, I'm seeing the goodness of integrating both things into my life. And so, I think, you know, I think more and more people are starting to talk about this. But I think this is something that I can share. You know, we go through these struggles, potentially for goodness, you know, you know, things will be made good. And we know that, you know, sharing our stories, and when they, people can see themselves in that, it can encourage them to seek the help. And so,
And your family is seeing you say, okay, I know I need help. And they're watching you work on that. And they're watching you work really hard at it. And then now you're able to offer repair, like you said, and just be more honest. Just because you have language for it now, and you have these tools, and before you have language and tools to recognize what's kind of taking over, you're not, it's just taking over, right? Like, there's no question, or there's no like, oh, I know what this is. There's no moment to recognize and to address it. And so the more we do that with our children too, the more they see the value in developing their own tools and their own skills. And then having the humility to say, hey, I messed up. I'm really sorry. Like, the more that we demonstrate the need to that, like, damage is going to happen, but repair is possible. That's like a huge life skill that I've had to learn as an adult that I didn't learn growing up, you know, and I learned it from my mom, like in her doing her own work. And so I think that there's just a lot of value in that too. And that wouldn't happen if you were perfect. They would just think, oh, I have to be perfect too. And then they would live in that like place of like, but I'm not. And so therefore I must be broken. And so therefore I'm going to, you know, shut down or use substances or just find an escape because I don't know how to address this in a real way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, that that whole restoration repair of relationships is going to take some time. You know,
totally.
It's going to take some time. They're going to need me or to see me and feel me like not, you know, kind of not lose emotional control when they go to do things. They're going to need to see that several times, you know. They're going to need to see me and verbally act that way several times so that they feel that trust again.
For sure.
You know, because that's that's damaging to think that my actions, reactions, and my words to try to keep them home or keep them safe, to think that that has not made an impact on them as a person, and then, you know, my relationship with them, to think that that didn't happen is just, you know, not right.
Yeah, totally.
And so that, you know, that daily healing for me of, you know, making choices to respond differently and to catch things when I'm, you know, thinking negative thoughts and things like that, that's continual healing. And I have to also work on that continual healing with my relationships.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that, and then we'll wrap up because, you know, you and I could go on all day. I say that with all guests, but really, truly, Dawn and I could go on all day. But I think that the other thing about that is with my depression, it became my experience as my kids got older, particularly Kyla, who's my oldest. We really do start to, there starts to be that swapping of roles where the only way to survive is to make sure mom's okay. And the only way that mom's going to be okay is for me to act a certain way, or for me to, you know, stay home when I want to go out with friends, or for me to compensate in some way to make sure I don't shake mom's already really fragile state, right? You mentioned that fragility before. And so the repair comes when my kids now know that if I'm having a hard day, like, it's not on them to act perfect or to make sure that I'm okay. Now they know that I have gotten the tools and sought the support, and I can call my mom, or I can call my friend, or I can call, but it's not on them. It's not just the three of us anymore trying to figure this out and trying to make sure that, like, we're all going to survive by making sure the person in charge is okay. Like, and I think that happens with kids a lot. It happened with me as a kid too. And so showing our kids that, like, hey, you know, I'm really struggling today with my anxiety, but I'm going to turn to this. I'm going to turn to God. I'm going to turn to prayer. I'm going to turn to these cognitive interruptions that I was taught to, like, recognize it. And then I'm going to face it. Like, that takes a huge load off of our kids' shoulders. But it does take time.
Yeah, that to think about that, and to know that that's what my kids were going through. That's the hardest thing.
I know. It's the hardest thing to have compassion for. And there is a lot of grief there.
That's why, you know, continually talking to my kids about it and recognizing and apologizing and, you know, reminding them of their worth, right? Uh-huh. And that their worth does not come from being perfect and what mom needs or what mom makes them comfortable with. And to think that this whole time, you know, they were having to make decisions based on my mental health, you know, and just like you said, like, what's going to make mom feel okay? Mm-hmm. Like, that's really hard.
It's super
to sit
hard.
In that.
I hear you. It's super hard. And I always feel like there's always an and this is not an excuse or an attempt to minimize. It has also made me, from my childhood experiences of that, and Kyla, my kiddo, like, the most empathetic I could possibly be in terms of, like, really recognizing when people aren't okay and then offering them support. So it can be turned into something that I think can be a gift if it doesn't go unaddressed forever, you know? And so even, like, when you think about your 19-year-old, like, there's a lot of repair there and there's a lot of grief and loss. But at the same time, like, she was also able to be the one that recognized, like, hey, mom's not okay, you know, and she's the one who's going to be able to, like, easily put herself in someone else's shoes in order to, like, in a healthy way, help them know that they're understood, that they're not alone, that like, help is okay, you know? And so it is this thing where there are two sides of that coin. And the more they see you healing and being honest about mistakes, the more they're going to trust it, and there is goodness that comes out of even our hardest faults.
Yes. Absolutely. I mean, I have to believe that. And I'm beginning to see that restoration and honesty, you know, honesty yeah. with ourselves, yeah. Honesty with our partners, honesty with our friends, honesty with our children. That honesty is what continues to help us all heal. And that honesty also, you know, opens us up to sharing so that other yeah. people can probably relate to us yeah. Yeah. and so and then seek their healing themselves, right? Yeah. And that's my goal of, you know, working with LIFT's online resource guide is to just make sure people know the resources. And yeah. There's all these entry points. I probably talked about that earlier, you know. At Healthy Mothers, Healthy Babies, we try to share with as many agencies and groups and professionals and people and families. We try to share as many resources as we can because you never know what entry point where someone's going to seek help and where maybe that provider does not have the exact resource, but they can help. They can help them, you know, get to the right resource because right. it's hard to ask for help.
Yeah.
It's really hard to ask for help sometimes. And so we just want to yeah. make sure that, yeah, that, you know, people can be offered the help that they need.
Yeah. 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 Okay. Thank you, Dawn.
We made it through. I'm so proud of us. A few tears.
Thank you to our incredible editor and producer, Brooke Boone Miller, for sharing her gifts with us. She is a mom, and she gets it, and for that we are so grateful. If you are seeking supportive parenting resources, please visit hmhb-lifts.org. An online guide meant to connect Montana families to services and programs throughout the state. It's okay not to be okay. Help is within reach, and you don't have to go this alone. We promise. And if Mother Love speaks to you as much as we hope it does, please consider supporting this project by subscribing to the podcast, sharing it with your network, and/or writing us a quick review. We are passionate about getting these stories out into the world, and we need you to help us spread the word. Oh, and just one more thing. We know a lot of moms who are really fired up about creating change in the maternal healthcare world. If you feel inspired to make a donation to this movement, please go to hmhb-mt.org/donate or click the link in the show notes. Even just a $5 or $10 donation can make a huge difference. Imagine a future where mothers and caregivers feel supported, seen and heard as they carry out the most important work of their lives.